Our reading today is from the first book of the Bible on page one, but it's a little way in. That's Genesis, and we're starting at the beginning of chapter one. So it's page one, Genesis chapter one. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse, and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. And let there be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds." And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good.
Russ, thank you very much for reading that. Please would you keep Genesis open, but would you turn on just a couple of pages to chapter 4, verse 25. Chapter 4, verse 25, and the birth of a baby. This is where we will get to, appropriately, just before Christmas. We're going to be going through Genesis 1 to 4 over the next few months. Chapter 4, verse 25. Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. That's where the story will end, with the least famous member of this troubled family. You have Adam and Eve and their sons Cain, Abel, and Seth. And just imagine Seth as a little boy sitting outside with his parents. What would Seth want to know? Mummy, Daddy, what went wrong? What went wrong? It's a question that we are more serious about today than at any time since the early 1980s, I think. I think climate crisis has taken over from nuclear war as the pin in our balloon of indestructible security. Younger people now ask, why would I have children and bring them into a world that is this messed up? Or last week on Bishopsgate, just out there, I was walking in front of a group of students talking about their career options back and forth until one of them said, oh, that's the kind of job I might have applied for if the world wasn't ending. And she was lighthearted, but I don't think she was joking. What went wrong with the world? It's a fair question at the beginning of the 21st century. It's a fair question from little boy Seth at the beginning of recorded history. In his case, he needs to find out that his big brother murdered his middle brother and then left home, and that there is something wrong with mum and dad, something about shame and failure, and something wrong with his future. It is all fragile and bleak and uncertain. But what went wrong? And Adam must have wanted to say, go and ask your mother, but let's imagine they are both there. So they share a nervous look, and then, let me tell you how it all began, how I first met your mother. In fact, let's go further back than that. Before anything else, you need to understand God. So turn back to Genesis 1. See, a version of that conversation must have happened, though we have no idea actually whether Genesis 1 is what Adam and Eve said to their child. But to that question from the human race, Genesis 1 is the prologue to the book of beginnings. The book of Genesis sets up the purpose and the reality and the plan for humanity from God's point of view. And chapter 1 introduces God. If you want to understand who you are and all the various crises that we stumble through and where we are going and what went wrong and why the human soul aches for a differently organized world, well, begin with God. Understand God, and then you have a shot at understanding yourself. And on the handout sheet today inside the hymns, there is a summary of where we're going this morning. And you'll see that our first and main point today, where we'll spend most of our time, is about God. God, point one, is far greater than we thought. One of the joys of open house weekend is that hundreds of people come to visit here, and many of them will stop and tell us what they believe. And so from yesterday, I can tell you that people believe in God. Lots of people still believe in a God, but the God they believe in is nothing like the person we meet in the first chapter of the Bible. I've also put on the sheet a sort of table of what happens in our verses. 6 days, arranged in the way that they're told, told with brilliant, dynamic brevity. We open with a universe without form and void. That's verse 2. It's the opposite of the cosmos that God made. There is darkness, it is empty, it's void, and it is formless, it is shapeless and chaotic. And over 6 days, we first of all see God bring form. he brings order. The left-hand column, the first 3 days, they are all about ordering or ruling. God creates light and then separates day from night into their right place. He creates an expanse and then separates sky from waters under the sky. He creates land and separates it from the sea. Until we have five zones of reality, five empty spaces, five voids formed out of the mess, day and night, sky and sea and land. And then in the next 3 days, we address the emptiness. The earth is void, and so God fills it. And each of these zones of reality is filled on the day opposite it in the table, the way I've arranged it. So day is given the sun, and night is given the moon and the stars, and the sky has birds, and the sea has fish, and the land brings forth living creatures, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth. See, those two main activities are what the creative God does as he builds his universe. And they're also the two commands given to his deputies. Next week, we'll meet them in verse 28, and they're in the reverse order. It's be fruitful, multiply, fill. That is like days 4 to 6. And then subdue, have dominion over, rule. That's like days 1 to 3. Order this precious creation. Bring right separations and beautiful blank canvas for more life to flourish and grow. See, humanity, who we'll meet next week, are to continue the creative process, to be like God and act creatively, which, just as an aside, just notice what that means about who the creative people are. I wonder if you've ever been beaten with this stick, as if, Jimmy is not very creative. He's more of a filing and organizing kind of guy. Well, the actual God in actual Genesis chapter 1, when he's creating the actual universe, spends the first 3 days filing, days 1 to 3, ordering, making spaces for the more showy, fluffy stuff to happen in days 4 to 6 as the creatives come along and strut their stuff. Six days to move from formless and void down to ordered and full. And within that framework, in every couple of verses is a deliberate pattern. God said, and it was so. God said, and it was so. God saw, and it was good. God saw, and it was good. That happens twice in the top row, day 1 and day 4. It happens once in the middle row, day 2 and day 5, and then 4 times at the climax in day 3 and day 6. All of this incredible order and fullness, it comes from the mind of God. And it appears just because he tells it to. He said, and it was so. This is not going to be a sermon about the mechanisms that God used to do all of that. Please come and talk to me if you'd like to. English evangelicalism has historically had no problem with seeing Genesis 1 as true about God without being too alarmed about whether it is also trying to describe how much time God took to make stars or anything else on the list. More recently, concern about that has come across from America, and I now have good friends with far greater scientific credentials than mine who take opposing views on both sides of that debate. But purely talking about the kind of literature we have here in Genesis 1, I don't think the author intends to address that subject. Six-day creationists, I think, should argue their case from other Bible passages, from places in the law where the six-day pattern is used as the basis for the Sabbath, places like that. But what we have here is so clearly arranged and patterned to teach us about God, not to answer precise scientific questions. It's not only that we have plants for a whole day before we have a sun in the sky. It is also that we have day and night for 3 days before we have a sun to set and rise. I think Genesis 1 has been arranged here to show us God's creative intentions, ordered and filled, and to show us, above all else, the breathtaking ease with which he did everything that he planned, everything as he wanted it. God said, and it was so. All of this because he wanted it, and he told it to. Do you see the kind of God that would be? The kind of God that would be. If he wants it, he can have it. Light, or planets, or stars, or fish, or birds, or monkeys, or us. We think that this chapter first came into this form under the pen of Moses. Moses, educated in Egypt, schooled in all the incredible variety of the myths and legends of the ancient Near East, where in those legends, the gods and the giants, they stumble about wrestling and competing, and the earth is formed out of the corpse of the one that lost a battle, or because one of them accidentally sneezed out life. And the universe that they live in is full of equivalent spiritual powers. The sun against the stars, against the moon, against the sea monsters, against the gods. But Moses met the real God. And the account here is radically different from all of the competing views of God then and also now. The order, the positivity, it's all good, it's all in its right place. The control, the sun and the moon, he made them. He commanded them out and he told them where to be and what to do. Oh, the stars, yes, sorry, they are a minor footnote in verse 16. They're not in charge of you. They don't tell you who you'll meet and what job you'll get. And they're not cosmic forces to be afraid of. And the sea monsters, yeah, they're in the verse 21, next to the shrimps on a list. One more tiny speck that God wanted, so he told them to be. God is not who you think he is. That's what this account is saying to you. People say, oh, I'm still a spiritual person. I do believe in God, but no, I don't know what that would mean for him to be real. I'm not sure about that. There are so many views, someone said to me yesterday. God gives me purpose, someone said to me last week. I don't go to the temple anymore or practice the religion of my parents, but I think we do need God to give us direction. Which direction? I don't know. God is not who you think he is. The God of Philip Pullman, who is the authority, who just got there first with a con trick about how he made everything before anyone else knew any different. Or the American Gods on the TV series by Neil Gaiman, who need human belief, otherwise they grow weak and fade. Or the God of deism, who set things up at the beginning but hasn't been so ill-mannered as to do anything else since then. Or the God of Freemasonry, who is the great architect, unnamed, flexible, distant. Or the God of generic 21st century spirituality, who is a force, like in Star Wars, or a spirit guide, or a comforting presence, but without the power to force you to do anything. Small gods is what Terry Pratchett called his book, published 10 years before his friend Neil Gaiman, I think, stole the whole mechanism and wrote American Gods. Same basic theology. All the gods are small, and they need us for life and power. God is not who you think he is. I was considering rolling out some funny story about mistaken identity and being rude to a teacher because you didn't realize who he was, but I think there is no acceptable parallel. Our species, by an enormous majority, has no idea who our Creator really is. He isn't someone who can be given a tolerated space in our lives. He hasn't agreed to be the one who brings purpose and who always agrees with what it was that we decided we would do in the first place. And we are unique in this. Every molecule and every cell regards God as the autocrat and commander, made by his words, obedient to him. The Lord Jesus Christ, when he appeared on earth, he just commands the waves. He commands corpses. He commands loaves of bread. And the molecules in them and the physics and the chemistry behind it says, yes, sir, when the Creator speaks. But our arrogance makes us imagine that we can find a place to stand and argue terms with our Creator, when nothing else in the entire universe makes that mistake. The flagstones under your feet and the London clay under them and the bedrock under that and the air that you breathe and the chemistry that turns that air into another 30 seconds of life for you, all of that relates to God like something that he wrote into existence, spoke into existence. God said, and it was. And that is not primitive poetry failing to understand subatomic physics. That is a fundamentally different basis for reality that is profound and challenging. Says matter is not solid in and of itself. It's not eternal and fundamental in and of itself. Matter is spoken, written into existence out of the mind of God. And it's interesting that if you read your favorite atheist, and mine is still Richard Dawkins, and they will say that they want a world and a humanity that is better and more realistic and more beautifully ordered, better to see ourselves as alone in this universe and uncreated, no one there with us, no one in charge. And Richard Dawkins, he talks at length about how he would explain the diversity of day 5 and day 6 in our accounts. And you'd expect that, because it's his field of study, he talks at length about how you get from single-celled organisms that are replicating to the variety that you see today, without any need for anyone to think or speak or write them into existence, given millions of years of random chance. But he is much briefer at the other end of that chain. The business end, you might say. How you explain those single-celled replicating creatures came to learn to reproduce, or why there would be chemistry at all, or matter, or the conditions for life anywhere in the universe. His explanatory cranes at that point are simply ideas and hopes with no experimental evidence whatsoever to explain what actually happened. You see, when we want to think hard here at St. Helens about whether science can explain the world we see without a God, often we invite my friend Andrew Satch to speak, who was an atheist and happened to be a scientist when he began looking into the Christian faith. And one thing he says that has always grabbed me, that I can't, though I can't keep the numbers in my head properly, he says the incredible unlikelihood that you would get the conditions for life like this by chance. He says it's like covering the earth in 1p pieces up to an enormous height and then just reaching down at random and finding the one that you painted red on the backside and picking it out. Here it is. I've got it just by chance. And serious scientists and serious everybody else, they've always looked at the universe, many of them, and assumed it was put together by somebody with a mind. And until you can show me the billions of lifeless multiverses where the dice rolled endlessly until we just popped out of nothing with everything in place, until then, this idea needs to be taken very, very seriously. The idea that the reason the world looks made is because it is. Because it looks intelligent and ordered and fruitful and beautiful is because there is a mind who spoke it into being. That the universe is personal data can't GDPR the universe, but that it is God's personal data, him speaking, that the tone of an individual voice is behind the things that we see and love and are amazed by. There's a person. It would be a different universe, a universe with a different relationship to the words of God. I think that's, again, why Jesus, in the verse we had earlier, says the best thing a human being can do is sit and listen. Every atom in physics would agree. God is real, and he is nothing like you imagined. And that is terrible news for human pride, isn't it? Shaking our little fists at the one who holds us on a rock, spinning in lifeless space. It's terrible news for arrogance, but it is wonderful news for anyone who wants to know what life is all about. I had a friend called Ray who was an artist. She taught at art college, and she painted and other things that I didn't understand, and she would invite me to private views, and I was sort of on the fringe of that art world there for about 5 minutes. And I heard her speak once at a youth group that we helped with about Genesis 1 and about what it's like as a Christian and an artist to sit on a train in London and see the sun go down behind a tower block and fill the sky with red. She said, it's like when I go to a gallery, because she was properly in the world, not like me for 5 minutes, and she was connected to proper famous artists. She'd go around the gallery and say, do you know, I know the one who did that. I know the painter. I know him or her. I know them. And she sits on the train and sees the sun go down over an enormous world where you can see the curve and says, I know the artist. I know the person who made that. Changes our view of ourselves in relation to him. He is far bigger. He doesn't need us at all. He's independent of us, but he wants to be known by us, the person who did all of this. The words that we said together on the sheets. God says, you can't build me a house. Don't be silly. I made everything. I don't need you. I don't need a house. But here is the person that God is willing to pay attention to, the one who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my words. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I'm going to skip over point two because we'll come back to that next week when we look at why on earth, with all of cosmic space laid out in this chapter, why it lands with something as insignificant as a human being. Why on earth would we be in the frame at all? Isn't that strange? That's all point two was saying. But just for a couple of minutes, look at point three. All of Seth's questions still remain, don't they? Now that Moses or Adam and Eve have introduced us to the real gods, all of Seth's questions, all of Extinction Rebellion's questions still remain. What is wrong with our world if it started like that and with a God like that? And it's interesting that the two things that I said at the beginning that young adults are giving up on, as in babies and jobs, are actually the two things gathered here in this chapter as the purpose of humanity. I think there's actually something quite sophisticated there. If the world is compromised, if the world has a serious problem, then actually babies and jobs and purpose in life are called into serious question if we're in that level of crisis. What the world is for if it is in this much trouble? And I think Genesis 1 that we've looked at today, seeing the world as it should be, makes it worse, doesn't it? Makes those questions louder, more vivid. If this is the way it should be, it should increase the volume on the anger and the loss and the sadness and the confusion about what is wrong with this world. It should be as good and as fruitful and as ordered as days 1 to 6. It should be ordered, not falling back into chaos and darkness. It should be producing life, not making species extinct. We should be somehow ordered and joining in and contributing, not tearing things apart and tearing ourselves and each other apart. And Genesis chapter 1 is not naive. It's not a just-so story. It's not optimistic in an eyes-closed sort of way. Maybe things will be better. Genesis chapter 1 is the beginning of the plan to take Seth and ruin humanity and a ruined world through to the rebirth of a new creation. That's what Genesis 1 is the beginning of. And the contribution of Genesis 1, the verses particularly we've been in this morning, is the power and the control and the authority of God when he speaks. That if God intends to take even the mess of our lives and the mess of our worlds and to speak into it and change it and rescue it and reboot it, then a look at the world around us and how it began tells us he is able. No one helps him do this in Genesis 1. No one stops him. No one argues with him. No one contributes. He can have anything he wants. He speaks and it is. And that is the God that we look forward into our future and the future of the rest of the Bible story with, to see what he will do with the mess that we have made. I'm going to pray and then hand back to Gwilym, and again encourage you to stay, particularly if you're a visitor, that we could talk more about some of these huge, important ideas. Let me lead us in prayer. Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What is the house that you would build for me? Our Father, we pray that we would listen attentively as you tell us who you are, that over all of our imaginings of small gods that we can control and use and negotiate with, that we would be humble enough to tremble at what you say and to come into the light of reality and the true God who is far, far greater than all we would imagine. We ask our Father you would graciously, kindly help us to understand and know you. For your Son's sake, we ask. Amen.